Good morning. It's great to celebrate, I guess, what the Westminster Catechism calls the communion of saints, right? Grateful to celebrate that with you all. My name is Dean Fulks. I'm the lead pastor. If this is your first time to be here, like I said, we're grateful that you're here. Those folks who are listening online, grateful you're listening with us today as well. We have been in a series called I Am. That's the revealed name of God in the Old Testament, right? God revealed that to Moses. And so over and over again, they use that name to describe God. I am that I am. And then in the New Testament, it seems as though Jesus shows up and he gives us context for what God is like. He says things like, I am the way, I am the good shepherd, I am the truth, I am the door, I am the gate. Over and over again, Jesus gives us this context. And so the way we've said it every week is that I am determines who I am. In other words, as God defines himself in the person of Jesus, he also defines us. As he bears witness to his identity defines our identity and who we then are. So like I said, I'm not sure. For some of you, I've been blessed to know you for a while. For some of you, I haven't had the opportunity to meet you yet. So I don't know how everybody got here. I know for Angie and I, my wife, we, 5 or 6 years ago, it seems like we were sitting down to have lunch with a couple. They were newer to our church, and so they were kind of describing their experience. And so the wife, she said, you know, we love the church, we love the experience on Sundays and all those kinds of things. But she said, but for us, she said, it's what you're doing with the kids. And she was kind of expressive. She got excited. She said, what you're doing with the kids for us, that was the first hooker for us. Now, she meant to say hook. But she said hooker, which is way better. So we decided we're rebranding our children's ministry to call it LifePoint Kids, Your Child's First Hooker. We think it'll be wildly successful. So I don't know what your first hooker was to get here. I don't know why you're here today. Somebody may have invited you. Somebody may have, maybe you just drove by and saw it and that's why you came today. But I do know this, that for all of us, there's this propensity when we first come to God because of our sin, because of our flaws, there's this propensity to come to God because we need God to solve a problem. And when we say we need God to solve a problem, we typically mean fast, right? Like, solve it now. That's how we kind of think about it. And we come to God, and that's okay, because we all do have problems, because we all do have situations and things going on in our lives. However, if you're not careful, you and I, we can come to God in that way and on that basis, and we can kind of become conditional disciples. In other words, we come to God and we say, God, I'll follow you as long as you solve my problem. God, I'll follow you on the condition that you meet this need that I have in my life. And so the reality of spiritual growth, and we've said this to you, I say it over and over again, I just like to remind you of it, is that there's a process that leads to a product. And we tend to spiritually want the product without the process. Last Sunday was Father's Day. And if you've been married very long, you know that if you want to have a great marriage, you have to enter into a process. It doesn't just happen. It takes time and energy and investment and work, and then more time and more energy and more investment and more and more and more work. One of the things that I've learned is that men and women, fundamentally, their brains work differently. They think differently. Women's brains are like iPhones, right? They can do multiple things at once. A female, or generally I would say, females can simultaneously think about what's for dinner, a sale at Kohl's, a friend who's in relational trouble, and reorganizing the garage. All at once, they can think about all those things. Men's brains are like flip phones, right? They think about one thing at a time. F-O-O-D. Generally, that's what you got when you got a man's brain. And so what happens in marriage is that you have to consistently learn, and you have to be reminded, and you have to grow in your aspects of relational love if you want to be great. If you want to have a great product, you have to engage a process. So when you think about that spiritually, we talked about a couple weeks ago, John chapter 10, we talked about the good shepherd. Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. He did not say, I have come that you might have belief, right? Now, As Christians, it's important, we say, we believe certain things that the scripture teaches. But it's not enough just to believe. You take the beliefs and you apply them to your life. As a matter of fact, one of the last verses in the Gospel of John that we've been looking at, John says, "These things I have written to you that in believing you might have life." One of the fundamental problems in American Christianity is we say, well, just, man, if you believe this, you're good. He doesn't say at the end of the Gospel of John, "These things I've written to you that in believing you might have belief." It's in believing that you have living, that you have life. So this conditional disciple mentality, this God solve my problem for me mentality, it fails over time. I've said to you before that in the Gospel of John, 57 times Jesus uses a word, same word, S-E-N-T, sent. It's a real important word in the Gospel of John. So say that on three. Ready? One, two, three. Sent. Real important word. If you and I had a conversation and 57 times in one conversation I used the word Trump, right? You would say, what's going on? What would that be like? It'd be like watching the evening news, right? Because that's all they talk about on the evening news. Doesn't matter, are you right side of the aisle, left side of the aisle? If an alien landed on planet Earth and watched the evening news, they would know that one way or another, that word is an important, it's a talked about thing in our culture. So if John writes us a letter and 57 times he uses the same word, it's important. We're gonna try and figure out how it's important today. So we're gonna take a step backwards in the Gospel of John. We're gonna start in John chapter 7. My goal is to connect us up John chapter 7 to John chapter 9 and show us the difference that word makes in our lives. So John chapter 7, and look at verse 2. It says this, "Now the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand." There are seven different festivals that God gave the children of Israel in the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 23 outlines them. One of those is called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. So seven times, I want you to think about this, seven times God mandates parties in the Old Testament. That should tell you something about God. Now the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles or Sukkot is what it was called in Hebrew. It kind of had a dual meaning. One was agricultural, one was spiritual. The agricultural meaning was that on the calendar it fell right after the harvest. So everybody's just harvested all their crops. They get together for 8 days and they celebrate the reality. They say to God, "You've provided the rain that provided the crops that we all now have to celebrate together and that we have food throughout the winter and into the spring." It was agricultural. It was also spiritual. For the whole week, everybody left their houses and they stayed in tents all week. So think about it this way. Think if everybody in Columbus all left their house, abandoned their homes for a week, and we all went tent camping together, everybody in the city, that's what it was like. The reason that they did that is because there was a spiritual reminder that came with the Feast of Booths, and it was this, that because of our forefathers' disobedience and because of our forefathers, because they didn't trust God when God said, "I'm gonna take you into the promised land," they wandered around in circles for 40 years. So it was a reminder to the current generation, don't trust in your own wisdom, don't live in fear, trust God, trust what he says, and live that out, not just believe it, live it out, practically speaking, in your life. Now, a part of the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, every day, a part of the party is that they had a parade. The leaders would come together, call all the people together, he'd bring out the high priest. The high priest had a jar, he had a pitcher, and they would have a parade all the way down to one of the pools. I'll show you a picture up here. Jerusalem didn't have a natural water source, so they had these aqueducts that they piped water in and throughout the city. And one of those was a place called the Pool of Siloam. So they would parade. Now, in the parade, everybody took part. They had dancers, they had singers, they had a rhythm section. So we're gonna reenact that this morning, okay? I can tell you're real excited about this. So from this pole right here, everybody over there, you guys are the dancers, okay? Now, because that could get a little bit, we could get ourselves in trouble doing that. We're gonna dance just by waving, okay? Just gonna wave back and forth. So, ready? Anticipation exercise, come on, everybody waving. Good job, good job. You guys in the middle, you guys are the singers, okay? So here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna do my best to hit a note, and you all hit the same note with me. Ready? Very good, very good, very good. You guys over here are the rhythm section, and we're gonna do that by clapping, okay? On the other side of the pole. So everybody got your hands ready? Ready? Do it with me. Here you go. Very good, very good, very good. Okay, so let's say it's parade time for the feast. The high priest is out front. He's got his pitcher, he's got his jar. They're on their way to the pool. And there were dancers, singers, clappers. Come on, singers. And they get to the pool and everybody stops. And he dips down and he takes his pitcher, the high priest does, in front of all the people. And he pours the water out on the ground. And the reason that he does that is a reminder to them that God provided water for us for our crops this year. And whenever he poured that water on the ground, everybody went nuts cheering. When he poured the water on the ground, everybody went nuts. That is lame. Like we just beat Michigan, okay? Come on, everybody cheer. Very good, very good, very good. They do that every day for 7 days. But I told you that the feast is 8 days long. So the eighth day, they called it the great day of the feast, right? So they would do everything the same. The high priest would come out, he'd take the pitcher, and the dancers, and the singers, and the clappers, and they get all the way there, and everybody stops, and the high priest takes the pitcher, and he turns it over, and nothing comes out. I like your attitude, whoever you are, I like your attitude. He turns the pitcher over on the eighth day, and nothing comes out, and nobody says a word. They called it a solemn assembly, and everybody was quiet. And you know why they were quiet? Because the eighth day, what they called the great day of the feast, was a reminder that we didn't trust God's provision. Our forefathers disobeyed and walked away from God. And because of that, for 40 years, they wandered around in circles in the wilderness. And everybody starts to disperse after that solemn assembly is over. Now that's the context for John chapter 7, right? And I want you to listen to this in verse 37. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out. And in my sanctified imagination, I've got to think it was in this solemn assembly moment. Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." I believe in the quiet of that moment, Jesus stands up and he says, if you're thirsty, come to me. See, because what happened in the Old Testament is that water took on a spiritual meaning. The psalmist said, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. The psalmist wrote, as a deer pants for the water, so my soul longs for you. Water, yes, had a physical meaning in a desert community, but it took on a spiritual meaning. And Jesus says, for those of you who are here today and all you have is belief and you're dry and you're bored spiritually and you feel like life is aimless and you don't have a purpose, anybody who's thirsty, Jesus says, come to me. And out of your heart, check that out of your heart will flow rivers of living water. What an incredible promise. Now that brings us to an observation about the text. Observation number one, providence takes precedence. Providence takes precedence. What I mean by that is that if God is our creator, then he is also our provider. We should probably have a festival every year about that to remind ourselves about how God provides for our needs. That word provide is a Latin word. Actually, it's two Latin words smushed together. First word, pro, is a prefix that means before. Second word is videre, which means to see. It's where we get our word for video. So to provide means to see before. Make sense? So when we say that God is our provider, in the Old Testament they call them a name, Jehovah Jireh, which means our provider. When we say that God provides, that means that God sees our needs before, and even before we know we have the needs, God has already met our needs. Now I didn't say wants. I didn't say you get everything you want. It's not this conditional discipleship mentality. As a matter of fact, we need to crush that spirit of spiritual, or that sense of spiritual entitlement that we have, where we just get whatever we want from God, like he's some sort of vending machine that's supposed to roll out whatever it is, whatever little lever we pull, and we get what we want. But God has provided for all of our needs. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, this is a participation exercise. Everybody take a deep breath and hold it. Ready? About 500 times since you showed up here today, 500-ish, you have drawn breath. About 23,000 times a day, about 8.4 million times a year, about 670 million times in your lifetime, you will breathe. And you don't even think about it until you get the breath knocked out of you or somebody holds your head under the water in a pool too long, right? You don't even think about breathing. But your body can't live without air. You can go ahead and breathe now. You don't have to keep holding your breath. I don't want anybody to fall out on me, right? You don't even think about it. It's an unconscious thing. Not only does God provide air for you to breathe, he provides the lungs with which you get to breathe the air, and it gets translated into your bloodstream to give your body and your limbs and your mind and your brain the things that your body needs. 670 million times, and 99.9% of those you don't even think about. God just does it. He just provides for you. That's why the psalmist says that every breath that comes out of us, all of our breath, should be what? Praise. Because breath that comes out of our body, supported by our voice box, turns into words, and all of our words should be praiseworthy. Why? Because not only has God provided breath and air, he has also provided the lungs with which you have to breathe them. That makes sense then that our words are not our words. Our words have been provided to us. Everything that we need to articulate words has been provided to us, so they should all be to the praise and the honor of God's glory. Whatsoever things you say, the New Testament says, whatever you say ought to be honoring to God. That's how we measure our words out of God's providence. I'll give you another example of providence. Our resources. I need somebody to help me. Sitting right there in the black shirt. Yeah, would you come here? Come here. What's your name? Griffin. All right. This is Griffin. Griffin, it's a good day at church for you, buddy. I've got $10. All right. That's your $10. Okay. So I'm going to give Griffin. I'm going to give you $10. Good day. Griffin's a smart dude, I can already tell. Griffin's looking at me like, I don't get to keep this 10 bucks, man. I've been here before, I've seen this show. No, really, that's your 10 bucks, all right? So what if I said to you, Griffin, that $10 is yours, but I forgot that on the way home, I need to stop and get a bottle of water, so can I have a dollar back? Sure, right. And so you've got that, right, and you can head on back to your seat there, okay? Good. I'm not kidding. If you feel good about taking $9 from your pastor, you just keep that $9. Now get out. Sit down. Bad pastor. I have to do this at 9:30 and 11, folks. This is an expensive sermon, okay? So you get the idea? I give Griffin $10, and I say, hey, I need $1 back. And Griffin, his response was, Sure. What if I said to you, Griffin, you just keep showing up Sunday after Sunday, and every Sunday we'll go through this same thing. I'll hand you $10, and just as a way to say thank you and do something nice, you give me a dollar back. Pretty good deal? Yeah, makes sense, right? All of the resources that you and I have are provided by God. Now, here's what you're going to say to me. You're going to say, well, yeah, God may provide them, but I'm the one who shows up 40 hours a week. I'm the one who punches the clock. But who gave you the brain to do what you do? For some of you, who gave you the arms, the legs, the physical ability to do what it is that you do to earn an income? Who's the one who organizes the appointments to help make the sales? All of that is provided by God to us. So what? So our resources are not our resources. They are given to us by God. So the floor for generosity for us is to say back to God, just as a way to say thank you and fuel God's work in the world. We say the floor, the starting place for generosity, God, is I'm gonna give you back 10%. So what happens? You don't look at it as, oh man, I got, you'd look at, I get to keep 90%. This is all, what an incredible deal. God has miraculously provided these resources and put them into my hands to use for the sake of his kingdom. So giving becomes a joy, not a chore, because God has provided. And so things like generosity and things like how we use our words become part of the process that we enter into, that God uses in our lives to develop us into conformity to the image of his son. A couple of weeks ago, my family, we got away for a week. We went to a place called Gull Lake Ministries up in Michigan. And while we were there, there was a speaker there. His name was Ron Capico. He's the chaplain at Spring Arbor University. He mentors about 60 college students at a time. And so if you could imagine what that would be like on the campus there at Spring Arbor. He told this story. He said that about a little more than 10 years ago, he's going into the Spring Arbor basketball game one night. The student is sitting there at the table where they're taking tickets. And the student's job was to sign people up for the halftime shot. So he walks in. The student's like, oh, Chaplain Ron, come sign up for the half-court shot. And he's like, no, I'm not up for the halftime shot. So as he walks by, the student says, don't worry, I'll put your name in for you. So he goes in, halftime comes, the announcer pulls out the name and he chuckles, and sure enough, he says, our halftime shot tonight is gonna come from one Ron Capico, our chaplain. And everybody claps for him. You know, Ron said he's not really ever played basketball. That wasn't his thing. He played football, but not basketball. So he walks out there, they throw him a basketball. It's not a three-pointer or a half-court shot. It's a three-quarter court shot to win a Chrysler LeBaron. They throw him the ball. He walks out there, takes one dribble, heaves it with one arm. He said the ball never got higher than the top of the backboard, nothing but the bottom of the net. Everybody goes crazy, and he doesn't really, he's like, what just happened? He just won a Chrysler LeBaron, right? So everybody's talking about it, buzzing about it. The next day, he's walking through campus. He walks by the gym where the guys are practicing basketball, and they all start screaming for him, you know, to come into basketball practice. He comes in. They're all giving him the bow, right? They throw him a ball, and they say, Chaplain Ron, do it again. Dude, he tried again, tried again. He's like, sure. One dribble, he throws it the length of the court. This time, he banks it in from three-quarter court. He's 2 for 2 on three-quarter court shots. A couple of weeks later, he's on a mission trip with some students to Guatemala. Well, they're in Guatemala, they're by a basketball court. The students start telling the story about him hitting the half-court shot, winning the Chrysler LeBaron and all that. The Guatemalans get excited. They find a basketball. They bring it to him, and they're like, do it again, do it again, do it again. And he's looking at me, and inside he said, I was thinking, there's no way, it's going to happen, so I'm going to throw up a hook shot. I'm just going to be a little fancy. So he takes the ball, one dribble, throws up a hook shot from three-quarter court, nothing but the bottom of the net. He's 3 for, there are witnesses to this. He's 3 for 3 on three-quarter shots, and he's never even played basketball. So he's telling the story, and all of a sudden he stops. And he says, you know, some people think that's how spiritual maturity happens, but they're wrong. See, some of us have this sense that just one day we're just gonna miraculously wake up like a three-quarter court shot, and all of a sudden we're gonna be spiritually mature. His point was, there's a process, and you don't get the product without engaging in the process. If we don't do that, what's going to happen? We're going to become spiritually entitled. We're going to become spiritual consumers, and we're going to expect God to give us things the way we want them, when we want them, how we want them, and we'll develop this conditional disciple mentality. So Jesus starts us off in John chapter 7. He rolls over to John chapter 8. That's where he says, before Abraham was Yahweh, I am. And then you get to the beginning of chapter 9. Jesus still in Jerusalem, and here's what happens. Chapter 9, look at verse 1. And as he, Jesus, passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud, said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means, so he went and he washed and he came back seeing. Jesus is making a point that you and I need to get the message before we get the miracle. Jesus and the disciples are walking through Jerusalem a couple of days after this whole water event happened, a couple of days after Jesus said, if you're thirsty, come to me. There's a man there, he's been blind ever since he was born. The disciples asked Jesus a question. Jesus, in other words, why is he blind? Did he sin? Did his parents sin? They ask a great question, and Jesus gives them an answer, and I'm sure they didn't like the answer any more than we like the answer. Jesus says, no. See, we want to blame somebody for every bad thing or what we think are bad things that happen in the world. We want to blame somebody. Jesus says, no. But we have the opportunity to work the works of God, so let's go work the works of God. Jesus spits on the ground, creates mud. That's a lot of spit, by the way. He spits on the ground, he creates a little mud, takes that little gritty, sandy substance, he puts it on the man's eyes. He tells him, hey, have somebody take you to the pool of Siloam and go and wash. And he goes and washes his eyes off. And when he does, his blindness is cured. He comes back seeing. And we read John chapter 9, and that's what all of us want, right? We all want the miracle moment. We all want the miraculous change. I sat with a family, 5 weeks ago, I sat and listened to them tell me how they got the miracle, right? Miraculous healing. Doctors can't explain it. They can't explain it. They were praying. They prayed. Bam, God healed. And it just is. That's the moment that we all want. And at the same time, there are other moments. I remember 6 or 7 years ago, Pastor Mark Shields and I went down to Nationwide Children's Hospital. We met with little Zachary's family. Zachary was 8 years old at the time. He had cancer. Cancer had compromised his immune system. He had gotten an infection. His body just couldn't fight it off. So he was in the hospice area. He was soon to pass away, probably not days, probably more like hours. And I remember Mark and I sitting and talking to Zachary's mom, and I simultaneously felt two things. One, just mad, just angry at the deterioration and what sin causes to our bodies in the world and how it breaks relationships and the hearts of the ones who love one another, just mad. And at the same time, I had this sense of admiration for Zachary's mom. I had this sense of admiration for the way that she was walking through this whole experience and the faithfulness with which she spoke about God in the midst of this incredible adversity. And I thought about her faithfulness really was the miracle, right? That was the miracle, that anyone could walk the way that she walked through this horrible, awful trial and process. Jesus, I think, is saying to us, we need to get the message before you get the miracle. What's the message? Think about it. Could Jesus have walked by this guy and looked at him and said, have your sight, and just spoken it? Could he have done that? Yeah. Could Jesus have reached down and put his hands over the man's eyes like this and said, be healed, and he would have been healed? Could he have done that? He could have done that. But instead, he coats the man's eyes and he sends him to wash in the pool of Siloam, which is called, and then the man's eyes are opened. I don't think that's by chance. I think Jesus is sending you and me a message. And here's the message. That if you and I want to understand our purpose, if we want to understand why we were created, if we want to have a sense of meaning and value, if we want to see the world the way that God sees the world, what do we have to have? We have to have a sent mentality. That we are all going to come into this world with this whole conditional discipleship mindset, this consumeristic attitude that's kind of selfish, that's me-centered, and what has to happen at one point or another is that we've got to have our eyes washed. We have to have our eyes open to this reality that the reason you are here and the reason I am here is not for you and it's not for me, but it's to reflect glory onto the God who created us, that we have to live sent lives, which is why Jesus says in the Gospel of John, as the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. See, your life is not for you, but that out of you would flow not a trickle, not just a cup, that out of you would flow rivers of living water. So how was Jesus sent by the Father? That's pretty important, right? For us to know, if we're gonna be sent like Jesus is sent, how was he sent? He said the Son of Man, speaking of himself, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Thank you. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life. So you and I are here not to be served, but to serve. So let me ask you a question. How are you serving? How's the serve meter in your life right now? How are you doing at giving your life? You're not gonna figure it out. You're not gonna figure out why am I here. You're not gonna understand meaning and value until you serve. That's what Jesus said. It's clear. So serve. You're like, man, I have no idea. Dean, what do? I don't have any idea where to start. It is your lucky day. A couple of weeks from now, on July the 8th, we have something called Life Teams Orientation. You can come that day. It's Sunday morning. We have childcare is available to you over there at LifePoint Kids. While during the second service, you can go to Life Teams Orientation. You can understand all of the opportunities that can become the floor of serving for you here at our church. You can sign up. You can look at the details in the listening guide. You can go to the app right now. You can go to the app right now, look at it, find the date in the app, and register to be there and to be part of it, part of learning how to serve, because serving is how you grow. Now, serving's not the only way that you grow, but it is part of how you grow. And if you aren't serving, you are short-circuiting your development as a believer, and you're not embracing to the greatest degree the capacity that you and I are sent by God, and that out of us is supposed to flow these rivers of living water. I'll tell you another way that you can serve. You can tell your story. You can invite other people into the narrative of God in your life. I've got no clue how to tell somebody. I don't know how to bring my story together. It's your lucky day. Let me give you three words that will help you put your story together, okay? You can write them down right there in your listening guide. Before, during, and after. Before, during, after. You've seen those, all the diet plans that you see on TV or on social media or somewhere like that, and they show you the before picture and the after picture, and you look at the before and the after, and you're like, yeah, I'll do that. If I go from there to there, I'm in. What they don't show you is what happens during, right? What you have to give up, what's in the middle. Before, What was your life like before you met Christ? What were the things you struggled with? What were the things that caused you to stumble at times? We don't major on that, but that's your life before, during. How did you come to meet Christ? Somebody invited you, you came to a service somewhere, you went to a Bible study, someone helped you come to know. That's the during part. After, how has your life changed? How have you engaged the process and seen fruit develop from your life? So what you do is you take your before, your during, and your after, sit down, write them out on a sheet, then you talk them through, read them through, and then you begin to pray for opportunities to share the story. I'll tell you another way that you can engage in serving the world, just by praying. You know people who have needs, right? Needs, not just for the needs to be met, but needs to the end that God would be glorified in their lives. If you all come here on a Sunday and you come through that middle door right over there, I'm guessing at some point you have been given a listening guide by Sandy Seeley. She stands at that door regularly, all the time, smiles, welcomes people. You know, Sandy prayed for her brother Bill to come to know Christ for 42 years. And for the majority of 42 years, there's no evidence, there's no change, there's no 42 years consistently praying, consistently praying, consistently praying. And yet at the end of 42 years, this moment comes, he's converted to Christianity. And I hear things like that and I think, my prayers don't even like, sometimes last 42 seconds, right? I can't maintain prayer for something. But when we understand that we are part of a sent mission of God to the world, that my life is not my own, my resources are not my own, my breath, my words are not my own. God has provided those things for me so that I can live a life that is engaged in mission and is engaged in being sent and seeking to change lives for the sake of his kingdom. Everything's different. That's why we say around here that God has called us to reach mid-Ohio, the Midwest, and the world. It's why we're willing from here to go to the ends of the earth, wherever we sense God calling us to be on mission and spread the good news, the gospel of who he is. I think about Mike Thomas. If you were here last Sunday, Mike was baptized. He shared his going public video last Sunday. We didn't get to share everything about Mike's story, but on the day that he came to know Christ, 6-7 or so weeks ago now, and Mike mentioned on his video, for 37 years, he was part of Mormonism. He comes here in an evangelical church, hears the gospel, responds day one. We give him a Your Next 30 Days book, and here he is, heads home. Well, unbeknownst to any of us and unbeknownst to Mike, he had made an appointment, 2:00 Sunday afternoon. What none of us knew is that the guy who was showing up at Mike's house at 2:00 on Sunday afternoon also attended LifePoint. So 2:00 Sunday afternoon happens, guy shows up, and I'm gonna paraphrase the story for the sake of time. Guy shows up, Mike's house, they make small talk for a few minutes. Somehow Mike asks him, do you go to church somewhere? The guy from our church that's been attending regularly for a number of years says, yeah, you go to church somewhere? And Mike says, you know, I went to this church today, and I'm not even sure I completely understand what happened to me. He said, but they gave me this book and it's gonna tell me what I need to do. And the other guy says, you know what? I think I was at the same church service you were at this morning. And what I love about that is for a guy like Mike, who's stepping out of 37 years, I'm not even exactly sure what happened to me in this conversion, not to a church, but this conversion that happened to me this morning to Christ. God didn't even wait 2 hours to provide, to see his need ahead of time, and to provide a person, unbeknownst to him, to come to his house as a way of confirming this decision that Mike has just made. There is no shadow he won't light up. There is no mountain he won't climb up. Coming after me. God has richly provided and provided and provided and provided for you. And the initial way that he did that is in giving his one and only son to be a ransom or a payment for your sins. Now, maybe you're here today and you're not a Christian. You're far from God and you know it. Maybe you're here today and you just have belief. really, you've not applied the gospel to your life. Day in, day out. The gospel really has, you've never applied the sacrifice of Jesus to your life to the degree that you've said, God, I'm a sinner and you're in charge. Whatever you say, I'm gonna do it. If that's you, either one of those, today can be your first day. You can make the same decision today that Mike made 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, and take that step into the kingdom and having a reality, a complete shift and a vision and a purpose and meaning that you've not known before. I'd love to help you do that today if you've not done it. Let's pray together. God, we are grateful for your love. We are grateful, God, that it's reckless in the sense that you provided it not at our cost, but at your cost. Not because you had to, but because you wanted to. Because you saw something in us and you chose to love. So God, I pray for anybody who's here today. I pray that God, if you've spoken to them this morning, that they are here to respond. So we just continue to pray right now. If that's you and you don't have a personal relationship with Christ, but you'd like to, I'm gonna pray up here, right there in your seat. You can pray with me to take that step of receiving Christ this morning. Just pray something like this. Dear Jesus, thank you for being my sacrifice. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for paying for my sins and giving me life. Jesus, today I'm turning away from my sins and I want you to be in charge of my life. Whatever that means, whatever that looks like, I thank you and I trust you. And we're just gonna stay in that attitude of prayer. Nobody's looking around right now. But the scriptures are clear that whenever you take that step, that you don't do it alone in isolation. So I'm just gonna ask that you would allow me to be the first person that you tell that you've done that. Just by raising your hand right now. Would you do that if you prayed with me? Just raise your hand. I'm not gonna ask you to say anything. I'm not gonna ask you to speak. Thank you. Just put them up and take them right back down. You say, today was my day. And Lord, I pray for those of us who are in the room who, God, have this tendency, this propensity in all of us to slip into that conditional discipleship mentality. And maybe this morning, God, some of us need to take steps with our words. Maybe some of us need to take steps in our giving, in our generosity. Maybe, God, this morning, some of us need to take steps in sharing our story, whatever that looks like. We would say this morning, God, that we are yours. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.